Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you so much for tuning in. Casey, can we get a little sort of, generic, like colonial times music in the background? Perfect. We've got a pitch for you today, folks. Have you ever thought about changing your identity? Have you ever felt that you should break free of the bonds of your previous life and become someone else entirely? That's a question we're addressing today. I'm Ben. My co-host Noel is off on adventures. However, we have a very special episode for you today with a very special guest, our returning friend of the show. Thanks for classing up the place yet again, Christopher Hasiotis.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I can't promise I can fill Noel's chair, but I will do my darndest.
I am incredibly excited about this. We've teased your return for some time over the previous episodes.
Great, yeah. Set expectations. Thank you.
We had very high. We asked people to write in immediately as soon as they heard your voice, but we didn't tell everyone that you would be coming on for this and maybe some other episodes in the future, but we're quite excited to have you. Thank you so much. I know you've been traveling a lot recently, right?
Yeah, we've got a lot of really great new shows in the works for the iHeart Podcast Network. So listeners, if you dig Ridiculous History, keep your eyes on your screens and your ears Ben, you're better at promoting than I am. What do you say?
Oh, ears to the wind?
Keep your ears to the wind of the podcast realm.
There you go. Oh, keep your eyes peeled, your ears to the ground, right?
Because right, and fingertips at the mercy of your soul.
There we go. Sure. I like the gravitas there.
Basically, I just want everyone listening to scroll through their iPhones or their Samsungs or what have you and subscribe to whatever strikes your fancy. This is just a long, ridiculous way of saying, yes, Ben, thank you for having me on. I have been up to a lot lately. We're putting together a great slate of new shows coming to the network, all centered around food and travel and stories of humanity and how all those things relate to our lives. I will have a lot more information for you and the listeners at Ridiculous History probably in the next month or two about some really, really great shows that they can watch out for and hopefully subscribe to and really, really dig. So in the meantime, I've just got, time to sit here in a booth with you, which makes me super joyful.
Oh, thank you. Also, of course, we are not diving into Ridiculous History alone. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Casey Pegram. Give it up for him, folks. Casey, I don't know why I stopped. Like, you were also going to put in an applause cue. But Christopher has just given us a delightful, tantalizing, I would say exclusive teaser, because this is the first time we've talked about some of these projects on air.
Yeah, on this show, yeah, that's right.
And so we'll say no more. You pay for the whole seat, you only need the edge, check back in a month or so, and we may have some new news for you. However, Christopher, you noticed at the very top of the show, we set up the concept of changing one's identity. Have you ever thought about this?
I remember when I was in college, I was at a rock and roll club, and someone had taped on the wall of one of the restrooms, over all the terrible band stickers and the graffiti and the cigarette burns and the scars scratched into the wall, someone had taped something that said, "Reinvent yourself, start a new life." And it was basically not quite an anarchist cookbook, but directions on how to access a manifesto, on how to essentially fake your own death and seize a new identity. Ooh. And there was just some sort of ne'er-do-well who was going around spreading these pamphlets around rock and roll clubs in the late 90s and early 2000s. So I don't know how many people out there are living under assumed identities. We can't all be Don Draper.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is anywhere that's prime for reinvention and developing a new persona and reinventing yourself, I mean, I think the United States of America is, like, that's one of the hotbeds for it, right? That's one of the things that we do. We burst forth from the shackles of our past. We reinvent ourselves. We set aside our family histories. We invent new family histories. We just present ourselves as we hope to be. And a lot of times people just kind of buy it.
That's true. That's so true. The word of the day I'll introduce here is pseudocide. That's the technical term for faking one's death or
love
attempting
it.
To do so. And today's episode hinges on, yeah, just as you said it, man, hinges on a fundamentally American idea. We have a somewhat romanticized or idealized concept of this purposeful reinvention, this resurrection, rebirth by design. But we don't often talk about the real life cases, in which these sorts of tropes occur. And today's story is about a person who did just that, who reinvented herself.
And that's the sort of thing that normally is, it's praised, right? To mm-hmm. come from humble beginnings, to set yourself up to a life that's grander than anything you could have imagined or that your parents could have set out for you. Mm-hmm. Normally, it's a good thing. Is that the case here?
Let's dig into it. How about that? Let's dig into it. And then maybe at the end, you and I can make the call. And fellow listeners, please chime in and let us know what your take is after you hear the entirety of the story, because it's important to hear the entirety of this particular tale. Our story today begins with a woman named Sarah Wilson. She was born in a Staffordshire village in 1754, and she was, I mean, relatively well off, not super destitute, because her father was a professional. He's a bailiff. However, they did have money problems. And the money problems were such that at the age of 16, Sarah is sent away from home and she is sent to London to look for employment. This was not terribly uncommon during this time.
No, it's not. She came from humble beginnings. You know, it's this West Midlands region of England. It's not super industrialized. She's looking for more opportunity. Like many people do, she heads to the big city. There are some suggestions. Maybe she wasn't just looking for money. Maybe she was off to seek her own ideas of fortune and fame and kind of build a name for herself, whatever that might mean. But she does head to London, and within a few weeks, she finds work. She's working as a maid for a woman named Caroline Vernon. And Caroline Vernon was a lady-in-waiting for Queen Charlotte. Now, Queen Charlotte, Queen of England, but born in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Spoke German accent when she's speaking English. You know, this is the sort of thing where looking back 300, 400, 500 years from especially the vantage point of the United States, where royalty is a bit of a novelty, we don't realize how little national borders and family lineage crisscrossed, and one may or may not have informed the other. So you have German nationals who are actually the king of England. You have people from Austria ruling Greece. You have the mix of whatever blend of Austro-Hungarian Habsburg, that situation ruling over bits and pieces of Europe. So it's sort of like a dual layer in Europe, and I always like to think that the movies just get it wrong because everyone's speaking with the same accent. Whether it's an accurate accent or not, it's generally somewhat uniform. Ooh. Whereas that's maybe not the case then, but I've fallen down a rabbit hole of just talking about historical specificity.
I think it's a great point, though, and you've picked the right show to do this on, because it may be difficult for many of us in 2019, in these our modern days, to understand that it was normal for the rulers of a country to be completely foreign in most – what we would consider completely foreign in today's terms and being quote-unquote qualified for their position entirely due to their ancestry. And that's what happens. There's a feedback loop around this time and the centuries preceding it wherein, you know, if you are a – member of a powerful family, you want your children to only marry members of other powerful families. And so things get mixed. I'm not making an inbreeding joke. I'm just saying that's how the thrones end up being collected and consolidated and passed around.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I will say that this discussion of languages and accents does come into play a little later on in Sarah Wilson's story.
Ooh, yes. Nice foreshadowing. Yes. Okay, so Sarah quickly ingratiates herself. She is a people person, a slick talker at this point. She is playing the role of the perfect maid as far as lady-in-waiting Caroline Vernon is concerned.
Yeah, and she's working at the Queen's House, which if you or I were to go to London or any of the listeners wanted to go to London and go check out the Queen's House, you can't find it because what's now there is Buckingham Palace. A little larger, a little more grand, but that original Queen's House. But that's the region of London we're talking about. It's still, you know, the seat of royal power.
Right. Quite prestigious, yes. And at the Queen's House, where, as you said, Christopher Buckingham Palace now stands, Sarah frequently saw the actual Queen, the wife of King George III, and she quickly, in addition to ingratiating herself with the upper crust of this community, she also familiarized herself intimately with the scuttlebutt, the gossip, the things that only the maids and the butlers and what Downton Abbey would call the downstairs people were aware of. And this got to her. You know what I mean? Because we know how human psychology works. It has not changed for many thousands of years. Happiness is often defined in comparative terms. So she is smart. She's quick-witted. She has escaped her small town and done more than many people in her town would have done. But then she looks around and she sees, you know, this opulence and these lives of leisure. And she says, I'm paraphrasing here, why not me? What do they got that I ain't got?
That's right. Yeah. I want to get me some of that.
Right. That's a quote. That's you pulled
exactly.
That
I think that was on some plaque somewhere in some dusty tome. But yeah, that's the thing. So Sarah Wilson, being around royalty, knowing the comings and goings of royalty, that wasn't enough for her. She wanted to get a piece of the action, have a slice for herself, carve out a little nook in that world. Or maybe she just wanted the things that she knew she would never, ever have on her own.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, this is such a stratified culture at the time. It still is in many ways. But when you come from completely humble backgrounds and you are spending your day around someone who is wearing, let's say, a ring or a crown or today a pair of sneakers or, you know, you drive a car that is essentially worth what your family could make in a decade.
Mm.
And this is just a trinket to this person. That wealth imbalance creates tension, and most people in the world can handle that. Some people can't, and Sarah Wilson was one of those people. So there was a night when she was by herself in the Queen's room. She snuck into a closet, breaks into this cabinet, and she takes some jewelry, some dresses, a ring, and a little miniature portrait of Queen Charlotte.
Hmm.
So it's like, you know, we don't have an image of what it looks like, but I imagine it's one of those little sort of cameo portraits, mm-hmm. and maybe a little silhouette. Just something that would be a keepsake, something that a family member of Queen Charlotte would keep and would refer to lovingly remember their relative.
Mm-hmm.
So she takes all these things for herself.
Yeah, and she thinks, it's no big deal. No one's going to find out. For Pete's sake, this is the Queen of England.
Right. She's got countless dresses, countless rings.
Scads of jewelry.
Yeah. But the thing is, they were not countless. They were counted frequently, as is the case with sometimes people of immense wealth. They also are immensely focused on the things that make them wealthy. And so Queen Charlotte was no different. She kept fastidious inventory of her inventory. She knew what she had and she knew when something was missing. So very, very, very soon after Sarah took these items, they're noticed missing. So the Queen says, all right, we don't know who did this. I need someone to keep an eye on it.
I thought that was quite clever too.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to just go off and start accusing people willy-nilly. That might fly with some royals, not Queen Charlotte.
Not Queen Charlotte. No, she sets up a surveillance operation. And think about how many servants must exist in a royal household. So there's clearly going to be several factions, and there's also going to be some servants that she trusts completely, and then some that are, you know, still a little green, and then some that she doesn't really interact with. So we can only imagine that she goes to one of the servants she legitimately trusts, someone or some people with whom she spent years and years, right? And she asked these people to watch not just the room, but this particular closet. And this is where Sarah Wilson makes her first error.
Yeah, I mean, the criminal returning to the scene of the crime, it's a trope in crime fiction, but that's because it happens. That's human nature. You know, maybe your prime criminal would go for the big score and then never touch that room again, never go back. But Sarah was not a professional criminal. She knew she got away with something once, so she went back to the well again, or in this case, the cabinet.
Yes, exactly.
But this time, you know, that Law and Order style stakeout, whatever was going on, it worked, and Sarah Wilson was caught in the act of trying to rob Queen Charlotte once again.
So this is very, very, very bad news. The way the laws work at the time, Sarah Wilson is charged with theft and violation of the royal privacy.
And that's serious.
That is serious, yeah. That is serious.
How serious?
More so than theft, violation of the royal privacy carries with it the death sentence.
Oh, that's serious.
Yes. So she receives the death sentence, and her original employer, Lady-in-Waiting Vernon, has not given up on her.
That's Caroline Vernon, right?
Yes, that is Lady-in-Waiting Caroline Vernon. And Caroline takes it upon herself to personally plea to Queen Charlotte, please spare Sarah.
She's made a mistake, but she maybe is a good girl. She comes from a good background. I like her.
And she's so young.
Right. She's what? How young?
16, 17 at this age. So her pleas work somewhat. And her punishment, the death sentence, is commuted to what they called transportation.
That sounds nice.
It does. It does. So she was just on subways.
Yeah. So where'd they transport her?
They transported her. Transportation, we should say, was a didn't mean the same thing it means today. Transportation was forcible exile.
Oh.
It's deportation would be the closest analog we have today, right? So in July of 1771, she is placed on a prison ship and sent to Baltimore, Maryland.
It's a long transportation.
It's a long ride. It is long. You wouldn't want to foot the Uber bill for that. However, things get worse. Because when she arrives in what would become the United States.
So it's 1771. We're 5 years before.
Right.
Everything kind of comes together.
Still just colonies.
Just colonies.
Yep. And she is not put in prison. She is not given some sort of state-level employment or colonial-level employment. She is put up for auction and sold as a slave.
So she can't just kind of do her own thing in the United States or in what would become the United States. She's just in Maryland, transported there against her will, although maybe willingly because otherwise the other option is to be put to death. But then she's just in servitude.
Yeah, it's looking grim for Sarah at this point. She is sold to a fellow named W. Duvall. He is a planter from Bush Creek, Frederick County.
Do you know what she was doing for Mr. Duvall?
I have not seen too much detail about that.
That makes sense, though, because I think she wasn't with him for long.
Right, right, right. She wasn't with him for long. And at this case, you know, it's an unpleasant thing to imagine, but physical abuse was prevalent with people who were enslaved in this manner, slavery in general. So while we do not have confirmed records of what happened during her time there. We know that she did not spend very long there at all. As you said, Christopher, she sought to improve her situation almost immediately, right? She escapes to Virginia, lickety-split, and she doesn't just go with the clothes on her back. This is the weirdest part of this story.
Yeah, honestly. This is the sort of thing where our lack of a time machine is just really a bummer, because I want to know the details of how this exactly happened. When she escapes, she still has in her possession, which means she brought over with her on her transportation from Britain, she still had one of the rings she stole,
mm-hmm.
she still had some dresses,
mm-hmm.
and she still had that miniature portrait of Queen Charlotte.
Which how do you have that?
I don't know. I mean, we like to think that systems of power are in place and everyone does everything perfectly. But as anyone who has ever dealt with, let's say, the police or the local county clerk or the tax
DMV,
collector, whoever,
yeah.
Sometimes people who are supposed to be doing their jobs, you know, they check the wrong box, they forget a comma. And then when you go back to renew, they say, wait, you're not even in our system. And you say, but I was in your system. I had a hyphen in my name and you took it out and they don't know what you're talking about. And then all of a sudden you say, I had a thing of Queen Charlotte and where is her? And no, I promise this dress is mine. And I think that's probably how it happened.
And the romantic in me, you know, the fan of fiction at least, has this cinematic moment stuck in my head, which almost certainly didn't happen, wherein the queen says, and take these garments with you. Take them hence. They are soiled. You know what I mean?
They've been touched by the poor.
Yeah, they've been touched by the poor, which should also be a crime.
So at this point, though, although we're going to be with her for the rest of this story, we kind of say goodbye to Sarah Wilson.
We do.
We say goodbye to Sarah Wilson, and we say hello to Princess Susanna Caroline Matilda, sister of Queen Charlotte.
Forced into exile in the colonies following a very enigmatic family scandal.
Oh, you don't want to talk about it. It's too hard.
It's impolite.
No, it's royalty. It's not the sort of thing you bring up at a polite dinner conversation in Virginia when you are a princess.
Mm-hmm. When you are a princess. And and also, it would be violating the privacy of the royal family.
And who would want to do that?
That's a crime.
That's terrible.
So this is strange. First off, the chutzpah alone, you know, congratulations to Princess Susanna Caroline Matilda. This is the kind of con that is difficult to pull off. However, she has several powerful things working to her advantage. First, as you mentioned, Christopher, she has all the stuff. Probably the most powerful or most impactful of the material possessions she has for her new identity will be that miniature portrait because of the sentimental value you mentioned earlier. But also, and equally as important here, she has intimate knowledge of life in the royal court.
Yeah, she's on the other side of an ocean, but she can still talk to people about the goings-on at the Queen's house, who's speaking with whom and who's falling out with whom and how things are going upstairs and downstairs. And, you know, she's presenting herself as Susanna Caroline Matilda, which I should also add, of Mecklenburg-Strelitz.
Oh, yes, very important.
Yeah, the Mecklenburg-Strelitz is a northern German dynasty sort of who— You know, Queen Charlotte was part of that family, and they've had their bloodline influencing royalty throughout Europe. But as the former Sarah Wilson is presenting herself as Susanna Caroline Matilda, princess, you know, she really harnesses, I think, a bit of nostalgia for what's going on back to because, again, a lot of the people living in the United States or what would become the United States still think of themselves as British subjects, as you know— not as American citizens. To them, the stories of the Queen, stories of the King, stories of what's happening in London, those to them are stories from home.
Ooh.
And so there is that nostalgia and that yearning. And apparently Princess Susanna really had an easier in with some of the older generation in Virginia, the ones who still thought of themselves as British, as English. And, you know, she could tell them what was going on and kind of let them relive their—and maybe it's been decades since they were back home.
Mm-hmm. And there's also this interesting mechanism that could occur whenever you're working with nostalgia, which is she could mention a name or a title that these people, especially the old guard, would have been familiar with, and then let them fill in the blanks based on the scant information she actually had. And when she does that, they would feel that they were learning something new, but just as importantly, they would feel that they were displaying their knowledge, and therefore they were still people with their, what do we say, with their ear to the wind, their eyes peeled, their
let's see there. Yeah, toenails to the grindstone, something like that?
Sure, yes. Their fingers are the toenails on the pulse. So they would still feel relevant having this knowledge. We can also, I think, reasonably assume that even for the people who were not the older generation, there was tremendous social cachet to be had in hosting not just a member of English aristocracy, but the sibling of the queen. And, you know, already, again, 1771, 1772, as you said, we're just a few years out from the Revolutionary War, as we call it in this country. And this also plays into displays of loyalism.
Well, that's the thing. So, you know, Princess Susanna is telling people she's been sent to the colonies because of some falling out back home. She can't get into the details, mm-hmm. but she will soon be restored to her rightful position back home.
Ah, yes.
And that's, you know, so she's at these dinner parties, at these salons, at these social events, mingling, wining, and dining. And so people are eager to really buy into the story, because if she's telling the truth, even if there's doubt in their minds, if she's telling the truth, they are now socially connected to a princess. So if she's restored to power, let's say they need a favor. Let's say they have a son who needs a high-paying position at a company. Let's say they need some land grants. Let's say they need to, raise an army for whatever they want to do.
Whatever that might be.
Yeah, you know, old rich people, they got things armies can do.
That is absolutely true. There is a third advantage that this part of American or colonial society sees, and that's, you know, I can pay you, princess, since we are such very good friends, the typical, let's call it an administrative fee, not a bribe, but the typical administrative fee that would be expected in order to have myself or a relation of mine granted a position, maybe on the court, maybe associated with it somehow with some government organ or body as soon as you return. And we know that will be soon. So they saw this as an investment in many ways. They were actually giving, this is where the con part comes in, they were actually giving Princess Susanna currency.
They were giving her cash money.
Yes, cash money. Yes, they were.
It speaks just as strongly 300 years ago as it does today. But also gifts. I imagine places to stay, mm-hmm. access to carriages. A nice bedroom for a week or
wardrobe.
Yeah, yeah. All that stuff. Here, have a horse.
Yeah.
Why not?
We've all been in that situation. Here, look. Take this horse.
This one? Yeah. For me?
Whichever one you
want.
I'm
not even a princess.
Whichever one you want.
But Ben, you make me feel like one.
Thank you, Christopher. Thank you, Christopher. I learned it all from Casey Pegram. But you know what, though? These sorts of shenanigans are increasingly difficult to pull off over time.
Over time. And so she went all over the colonies. This wasn't mm-hmm. just Virginia. This wasn't just Maryland. She was in Georgia. She was in the Carolinas. She met the governor of North Carolina. I mean, this is like high level stuff. She has access. But people have some questions.
That's right. And they want to be very careful with the manner in which they pose these questions.
To someone like Princess Susanna Carolina Matilda, sister to the queen, family of Mecklenburg-Strelitz.
Nailed it.
Not only— But she had a couple other aliases, too. She also went by the Marchioness de Waldegrave. Mm-hmm. She was also known as the Princess of Cronenberg.
No association with the director.
That we know of.
That we know of. Yes, that's very fair. She would use these names on different occasions, and she would, as you said, travel widely. She was meeting tremendously influential people. And folks were starting to ask questions because in these circles, there would be people who speak German.
Yeah. And if she was supposedly from Germany.
Raised in Germany.
Yeah. How come you don't speak German?
Right. She refused to, perhaps because of the quarrel.
Yeah, or she was in the new world speaking a new language. But even then, she spoke perfect English.
Flawless English, yeah.
You know why? Because she was English.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a real Kaiser Soze moment for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, people were saying, well, that's weird because I have been speaking English for decades and decades and decades. I grew up speaking German, and I still have a little bit of an accent. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So why is she flawless with it? And then there was another question that seems very obvious to us in retrospect.
Well, it's the one where everyone thinks, wait a minute, does Queen Charlotte have a sister?
Right. Why haven't I heard of her?
Maybe she's able to turn it around and really play on people's insecurities and say, maybe I wasn't important enough to know about the Queen's sister.
Ooh, yeah. Or maybe you're not as plugged in as you want other people at this dinner party to believe. And so people probably for some time, that strategy is effective and people are reticent to voice their concerns because they don't want to seem to be the odd person out.
Might I also suggest that maybe men act a little dumb in the presence of someone who might be a princess?
I think that is an excellent suggestion. Having not, to my knowledge at this point in life, interacted with a princess, I can't speak from experience, but I feel like that is unfortunately a very astute observation.
Men can be dumb.
No way.
It's true.
So you're right, though. That's a good point. That's one that a lot of historians don't talk about.
Well, it's not necessarily brought up. It's not like all these people who are giving her gifts are described as suitors, mm-hmm. particularly. But knowing men, knowing that sort of patriarchal society that was in place at the time, I have to imagine that some of these people who are wealthy landowners in the colonies meeting a single young princess,
uh-huh.
plying her with gifts, might have some motives of marrying into royalty or other motives.
Yeah, absolutely.
And men will do dumb things.
Yes.
When they have those motives.
Absolutely. I mean, I would say people in general, but in this situation, it's only fair to note that trend toward thick-headedness is probably accelerated in men.
But the scam didn't hold.
The scam did not hold because, speaking of men, we have to reintroduce a character that briefly appeared earlier in the tale, Mr. W. Duval, who, it turns out, is not happy about Sarah Wilson, as he knew her.
And maybe not that dumb of a man, because eventually, after a couple years pass, he hears a description of this princess.
Mm-hmm.
He hears talk, and so he probably says, oh, that, wow, a princess in the colonies, that's interesting. What does she look like? And they say, this is what she looks like. And he says, I know someone who looks like that.
Yes.
And it's Sarah Wilson.
And he has been trying to find this, the one that got away, literally. So it is autumn of 1773. Remember, she's been on the run since 1771-ish. And he's
been looking for her, actually, since 1771. I have here in front of me, from the Pennsylvania Gazette, published on October 11th, 1771, an advertisement for a runaway slave. And this is what William Duval wrote in the newspaper back in 1771. He took out an ad. Run away from the subscriber, a convict servant maid named Sarah Wilson, but has changed name to Lady Susanna Carolina Matilda, which has made the public believe that she was His Majesty's sister. And here's where we get into the realizing what she looked like. She has a blemish in her right eye, black rolled hair, stoops in the shoulders, makes a common practice of writing, and marked her clothes with a crown and a bee. Whosoever secures the said servant woman or takes her home shall receive 5 pistoles besides all costs and charges. So if you find Sarah Wilson, all your expenses are paid,
mm-hmm.
and you get 5 pistoles.
What a deal.
5 pistols. And I should say, I'm going to applaud myself for reading that, because this is an old-timey advertisement from an old-timey newspaper, and it's got those medial S's.
which are such a pain.
They look like an F.
They do look
an
like
F an F without the crossbar. They go all the way back to Old English, and I'm glad that they're gone now. You know, the thank you movable type. We don't need all those weird looking S's that make everything sound like an act of Congress.
An act of Congress. Yes. Yeah, it's true. Those are paid. And I applaud your recital there, Christopher.
I applaud Casey for cutting out all of my flubs. Well, that's the thing. You use a curvy S at the end, and but not at the beginning. So if it looks like the word flub is flub, but the word flubs would to us look like flubs.
And we can only hope that old man Willie D was going through the same process as he was writing this advertisement.
So I really, really hope at some point there's some sort of merchandise out there that people can have a bumper sticker or a little pin or some just gaudy T-shirt they can wear that says, you know, I am a proud, ridiculous Hiftorian.
That's great. Casey, do you like that one?
I love that idea.
Hiftorians, yeah.
Yeah.
Medial S's for everyone.
Casey on the case. We'll put it to a vote, too. Let us know what you think about these. What are they called? Medial S's?
A medial S, yeah. It's also known as a long S because a short S is the short, round one or curvy or, you know, just an S, as we would as we would say.
I like the I like the depths of resentment that are emanating across the table.
Hey, Matt, you didn't have to read this, so we do have another bit of old timey newspaper right here. I may pass it to you and put you to the test.
Oh no, we've created a monster, but it's
monster.
That's fun to say, actually.
I think we should get back on track. So they're on the hunt.
Yeah, the word is out. And in addition to publicizing this advertisement and appeal and offering this reward, he, Willie, sends one of his employees, a man named Michael Dalton, to retrieve Sarah. Dalton has, a certain set of skills, Liam Neeson style, we can only assume, because he does eventually track the princess down to a plantation in Charleston right after she left. So he is hot on her wake, hot on her trail. And then he doesn't give up. He follows the clues, Carmen Sandiego style, and he finds her at a neighboring plantation. He captures her. He takes her back to that estate in Bush Creek, Frederick County.
And that's in Virginia?
Yes. Yeah, that's in Virginia.
Is that the end of the story? She just gets captured and she goes right back into servitude?
Yeah. Sometimes things just end. I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Okay. I was ready to go home on this pony.
Right. Well, you still have to take some time to name the pony before you ride it out. And I would advise something heavy on the F's and the S's. But this is not the end of the story, is it, Christopher?
You know, it's not. There's more scamming ahead, as may not be so surprising with Miss Sarah Wilson. So Sarah is on the plantation. She's working. At this point, it's 1775, though.
Mm-hmm.
But Duvall's not at home because he has left the plantation to fight in the militia for the American War of Independence.
Yes, which we now know as the Revolutionary War. And while he is gone, a very, very strange coincidence occurs. This is the kind of thing you can't write in fiction because no one will believe you.
Yeah, it seems like this seems like a really unsatisfying end to things because it's just so improbable.
Mm-hmm.
But according to the historical record, this is what happened. Another either enslaved person or servant girl, also by the name of Sarah Wilson, crosses paths with Sarah Wilson that you and I and the listeners know.
And this is very vague. We want to let all of our fellow listeners know we are very well aware that this is incredibly vague. Somehow, our Sarah Wilson, the former princess, is able to switch, I guess, bodies or make people confuse the new Sarah Wilson for her. And then during this confusion, while her owner is away, while this creep Duvall is away, she escapes, and this time she heads north.
Yeah, the southward direction did not work out so well for her in the past when she was a princess. So she splits. She goes north. She leaves Sarah Wilson the second in place of Sarah Wilson the first. Too bad for Sarah Wilson the second, I guess. Like, this is the end of her story. Although maybe she was already going to be on that plantation anyway. And Sarah one was like, "Oh no, no, that's Sarah Wilson over there. Are you looking for Sarah Wilson? That's Sarah. Hey, are you named Sarah Wilson?" And she says, "Yeah, that's me." And then she's like, "Well, I'm just going to walk away as you guys go talk to her." And you know, there's just a lot of this, like, convincing people and gift of gab. You know, you've got to really be a smooth talker. This reminds me of the story a little bit of that bridge.
Yeah, yeah. Tabor Bridge, right? The two French marshals who decided to con their way across the Danube.
Yeah, you and Noel had a really great episode about this. And
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, you know, Ridiculous Historians. If you have not listened to that episode, go dig it up. I mean, we kind of just gave you the surprise ending, but it's still a great story regardless. There's all sorts of weird boasting and French chest puffery and, you know, almost bombings and Hungarian confusion. And which, by the way, really good band name, I think.
Hungarian Confusion. Yeah. That is an excellent band name, my friend.
Yeah.
Hang on. Sorry, everybody listening. I'm going to write that down. Okay.
Ben's actually just filing for an LLC right now for himself.
Yes. Hungarian Revolution.
But Sarah Wilson, she is not confused about what she's doing. Mm-mm. She heads out of Virginia, goes north, and at least for the foreseeable future, lives a somewhat normal life, still has a lot of her money, which she... Again, where
is she putting
where
all
does
this
the
stuff?
Money go? Where does she keep it? Are there secret bank accounts? Does she have secret pockets?
Has she literally buried boxes of coin?
Maybe she has just like a lot of hair.
Yeah.
Like just like a huge head of hair, and there's just like envelopes of money in there.
Mm-hmm.
Could be.
I mean, at the time, it may have been a sound investment strategy.
Perhaps, yeah, or you know. Some money sewn into the lining of a coat or something like that. Anyway, she's got all this money, and she ends up all the way up in New York. She actually meets a young military man named William Talbot.
Or alternatively, Sterling.
Oh, is that right?
Well, sometimes it differs. It depends on the source. But yeah, she meets a nice young man.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a military man. He's a officer in the Light Dragoons. And the war transpires, spoiler alert, this part of the North American continent becomes a country we call the United States today.
Heard of it.
Okay. Yeah, you're familiar with its work. And the couple decides to stay in this new country.
What are they doing?
Probably they're avoiding arrest for Sarah
if she returns
to England. But they also, she uses her money. Maybe she did this. Maybe she kept jewelry. And then sold the jewelry.
Uh-huh.
That might have happened. But she uses this money that she has acquired to set up her husband as a businessman. And they live, as far as we can tell from the record, they live happily ever after. They have a lot of kids. And they set up their residence in the Bowery in New York, which at the time was a quiet, nice neighborhood.
Kind of a happy ending for her.
It is, especially when you consider how close she came to very, very terrible things. I don't know. It also reminds me, in a way, you remember that Disney film Pinocchio, right?
I do.
Stories. So as a kid, I thought Pinocchio was really cool until one of my friends later on, years and years later, pointed out to me that Pinocchio has this horrible lesson for children in terms of morality.
Tell me about it.
Well, I'll keep it brief. But Pinocchio, from his beginning, is told to do the following kind of things or not do these things so that he can ultimately become self-actualized and be a real boy. He breaks all of those rules or those commandments or whatever. And then at the end, he gets the reward anyway.
That's true.
So did Sarah Wilson have a moment? We can tell. One thing we can tell that differentiates her from other con artists is that when she got to a good spot, she stopped. There are other con artists who just can't give up the game.
Well, there was a point, though, you know, and And this is where I'd like more detail about her life. Mm. And you know, I mean, this to me seems ripe for some Hollywood tale, and I'd love to see this turn into a film and really dig into the story. But there was a time before she met her husband, after she escaped Virginia.
Oh, yes.
Where she had this little side escapade, and there's not a lot that I could dig up about this. But she teamed up with this criminal who was known by the alias of Tom Bell. He was an Irishman, mm-hmm. Also known as Patrick O'Connor. But they kind of worked together for a while, and he introduced himself to people as Mr. Edward Augustus Montague, a gentleman of fortune and betrothed lover of Princess Susanna Carolina Matilda.
Yeah.
So maybe the princess came back after her flight from Virginia and before she settles in New York. Maybe there's this sort of interim of her flirting again with this world of intrigue and all the scams.
Yeah.
And I don't know much about it.
We don't know. Like, we as a species don't know much about this part of her life, which makes it by far one of the most intriguing and fascinating. We don't know much about Patrick O'Connor nor his alias Tom Bell, but we do know they did. For a brief time, she did go into a two-person con act. And who knows, maybe they really were betrothed.
I don't know. I mean, he was a fairly well-known criminal at the time. I mean, this could be the sort of thing where maybe they pulled off one last heist and she got out of the life. It's a sort of, you know, like a Danny Ocean kind of situation where she teams up with this acclaimed crime guy. She gets what she needs and, you know, she has her happily ever after.
You also have to wonder whether the man who ultimately became her husband knew about her stint as a princess. Did she tell him her true story, or did she say, like, maybe I'm an orphan and this is my family fortune?
Yeah.
I love you. I don't want to talk about my past. Let's start a new life together in the Bowery. And then maybe he just went head over heels, Christopher. Maybe he was just like, well, I'm in love, and being a dude, I'm kind of dumb.
And I do need some money.
And I do need some, as you said, cash money.
Speaking of cash money, Bennett, I thought this might be a good way to wrap up because this is a little off topic, but it's related to some royalty and some cash money. I wanted to get your opinion and Ridiculous Historians, if you have any advice for me. I got this email from a Nigerian prince.
Oh, okay. Do tell.
And he's asking for some money.
Okay.
Should I help him out?
How much money is he asking for?
More than I've got.
Oh, okay. Then without having a doctorate in finance, I would advise you, depending on how much, well, first, how much time do you have?
I don't have enough time. Spoiler alert.
Yes.
I'm not giving this guy any money, but the thing is, you know, we're talking about this weird scam of someone putting themselves forth as royalty, and it sounds like the sort of thing like, oh, this is just a thing that, you know, those historical rubes back in the day fell for. It's going on still. I in preparing to come chat with you guys here, I did a little digging, and there was a report last year from the Security Services ADT. In 2018 alone, people in the United States fell prey to the Nigerian scams and other sort of email scams like that, where people are just asking for money, to the tune of more than $700,000 last year alone. And it averaged out to about $2,100 per person.
Wow.
So this scam of royalty, this desire to buy into a story, this ability to be hoodwinked, you know, I think it's just baked into humanity. It's just who we are.
Yeah.
We want to believe. We want to help. And if someone says they're a prince or a princess, hey, why not?
Wow. And it gets our inner Fox Mulder, huh? I want to believe. What I was going to advise you to do, off the record again, not being a doctorate, just between you, Casey, me, and the millions of us listening.
Yeah, you're not recording this, Casey, right?
Right. This is all off the record.
Perfect. So, perfect. Yeah. I don't want this out in the world. That would be embarrassing.
I've read accounts of people who essentially scammed the scammers, which is on the murky side of unethical pranking.
What are you talking? That is fighting the good fight.
Well, the idea is, you know, they'll say stuff like, sure, you've contacted me. I do have this money. I will give you this information. But first, I want to know, first you need to prove something in good faith or whatever. And I've found situations wherein someone convinced the scammer or someone who knows the scammer to get a tattoo or to write essays about Harry Potter and things of that nature. So if you have the time and the inclination and you don't feel particularly guilty about trolling people who are trying to steal from you, then then I would advise to find the funniest prank to pull.
We'll check back in.
We'll check back in, and perhaps, Christopher, one day you will be known too as a genius of the con, because one of the most American things about the way we treat con artists here in the U.S. is that they are often begrudgingly admired. You know what I mean? The idea of this slick-talking, clever individual violating social norms and getting away with it, it's imprinted into our DNA. And that's why the Providence, Rhode Island Gazette and Country Journal in January of 1774 noted that Sarah Wilson is, quote, the most surprising genius of the female sex that was ever obliged to visit America. Let's just walk past that blatant, you know, misogyny there. They're basically saying smart for a woman because they're being jerks. But what they're also doing, and what I think is more important for our purposes here, is they are praising the intelligence of this person. They're saying this is one of the smartest people in this country. Too bad they're not a politician or, you know, a philanthropist.
Can't win them all.
Can't win them all. But I feel like this was a big win for Casey, Noel, and Spirit and I to have you over on the show. And we hope that you enjoyed this episode. We want to hear from you. Let us know some of your favorite historical cons other than the Trojan horse. Other than that one, you know, that's sort of like going to karaoke and playing Don't Stop Believing.
And whatever we want to call this con of you somehow being convinced to let me sit in here and chat with you guys. I feel like I've scammed everyone.
Hey, yeah, that's a good question. Is your name Christopher?
Isn't it?
I don't know. Casey, I believe him. He's just got such an amicable air about him, you know?
No comment.
All right, just call me Princess.
Oh, wow. You guys are in on this together. Well, here's hoping that I don't get scammed out of millions of dollars. But if I do, I'm glad it was from you two. Thank you, as always, to our super producer, Casey Pegram. Thank you to Alex Williams, who composed our track. Thank you to Gabe, our research associate. Christopher, we often thank you on this show, so it's a little strange that you're here now. I'm really glad to thank you in person. Thanks for coming on, man.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Ben, and thanks for having me, Ridiculous Historians.
And stay tuned for our next episode, wherein Christopher and I will explore not a con.
No, things are going to get a little grimier.
Grimmer.
Grimmer. Grimmer, grimier. Just a little dark, a little gross, but fun. Still ridiculous.
Stay tuned.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.